United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. This is the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guests are poets Corey Van Landingham and Chris Kempf, artists in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Corey Van Landingham is the author of Love Letter to Who Owns the Heavens and Antidote. Her work has appeared in The Best American Poetry, Boston Review, The New Yorker, and elsewhere. Corey's PhD is from University of Cincinnati. Her MFA is from Purdue. She is a visiting assistant professor of creative writing in poetry at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chris Kempf is the author of Late in the Empire of Men. His work has appeared in Georgia Review, New England Review, The New Republic, and Pen America, among other places. His MFA is from Cornell. He is a doctoral candidate in English literature at the University of Chicago, where he holds the Hannah Holborn Gray Advanced Fellowship in the Humanities. Corey and Chris, welcome to the Seminary Explores.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's so good to see you again, Katie.
Would each of you mind saying something about why this particular residency called to you in this place and at this time of your lives? You each have won very significant awards. You've lived in different places geographically, and you also have your own sort of personal and professional connections to Gettysburg. So would you like to share a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. It's so funny. I taught for a year at the college here, and I think it was the week that I moved from Gettysburg that I began to write about Gettysburg. Mm. And so there was something about not being immersed in the constant wonder and kind of barrage of history that made me really want to start writing about it. Mm. And I couldn't quite do it when I was here. I think I was trying to really listen, to pay attention, to kind of keep all of my feelers open. And so I think the farther that that's gone on, that's been about 3 years since I moved, I've just wanted to get back. And especially to me, I'm writing a lot about the landscape, mm-hmm. and about art. And so it was important to me to really come and take a break from reading about it and to see again. And it was a kind of a perfect experience and timing because we wanted to be here during the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah.
I like to write about spectacle. And so, of course, there is so much spectacle here this time of year. So.
Very good.
Yeah, for me, it's the exact opposite. From the first day we got here, I knew I wanted to write about this place. I remember the first night we got here, we were in a Penske truck, and we parked somewhere over by the Pennsylvania Monument, and we stood at that wall and looked out over to West Confederate, where Pickett's Charge would have been. And I'd been here to teach. I hadn't been planning on writing about Gettysburg. I wanted to work on my dissertation, but it just took over my imagination from that point on. And I couldn't, for the whole year and a half I was here, I couldn't write about anything but this place. Hmm. So I'm finishing up a book of poetry mostly entirely about Gettysburg now. And I wanted to come back here and kind of, I have about 4 or 5 poems I got to finish off still. And I'm hoping that happens while I'm here.
So, and actually that was my next question, was about your focus or your projects while you're here. So you're finishing up the collection?
Yeah. That poetry, it's a poetry collection, it's called What Though the Field Be Lost, and that's coming out from LSU Press in 2021. And that title comes from Paradise Lost. Satan says it. Mm-hmm. He's in hell and he's looking up at the field that he lost. Mm-hmm. And it's a book that takes Satan in the Civil War was invoked all the time as the prime secessionist, this rebel who, rebels from heaven. And so that was how the South was talked about, as this kind of satanic force seceding. And so I'm trying to think about Paradise Lost as a way to think about a nation splitting. And in particular, what captivates me about this place are the Southern monuments. Mm-hmm. it's a cause that we would unquestionably condemn, of course, but there's a real pathos in the monuments, in the rhetoric with which they conceive their own cause, or which they view themselves, and how they try to spin it is really impactful to me. So I'm trying to kind of, like Milton does, empathize with Satan a little bit, empathize with a cause that we would condemn. And so it's a project, like, I guess, invested in ethical plasticity or empathy across ethical disagreement.
Great.
And what I'm working on is it's in the beginning stage, I would say. Mostly I'm writing essays right now. And like Chris, I'm thinking about the monuments. But I'm trying to connect them a little bit more with elegy. And so I'm thinking of them alongside the passing of my father, who was a photographer. He was an amateur photographer, but still it was really important to him for most of his life. And so I'm trying to think about different forms of aesthetic representation and about that kind of moral complexity of things get a lot more power when they're gone, or when they're lost, like the South, and how, you know, it's so much more emotionally grandiose, those statues, because they lost. They had something to lose and they were fighting for that memory. And I'm thinking of that alongside my father, and, you know, people become shinier sometimes when they're no longer with you, and trying to keep alive fitting emotional and portraits of people while still thinking of their complexity at the same time. So I'm also writing about the cyclorama, and Chris has a poem about that as well, and I'm trying to write an essay right now. And so what's so interesting is at the time of the war, landscape painting was all the rage, and so those artists went into the battle, and they were mostly focusing on the landscape, and they weren't really looking at the soldiers. Things were very, like, romantic and grandiose, and but that wasn't really the best art necessarily. And so I'm thinking about how when the cyclorama came, that was around like the 1880s, and the Civil War art was much more in vogue then. And right afterwards, people understandably didn't really want to relive it for a while. And it kind of fit the ability to have the landscape, because it is such an incredible landscape here, with more fitting and astute portraiture at the same time.
What you said about portraiture is interesting, because there are a lot of different ways to do a portrait, aren't there? Visually and verbally, and there are a lot of expectations around what's a proper portrait. So that's fascinating, the project that you're working on.
Thank you.
I was wondering, Chris, if you might say something about you have this essay, The Art of War Poetry, which I find extremely interesting as a way of, so we're on this historical battlefield here, and of course life in Gettysburg is just, you know, you sort of taste and breathe the past, but the way that poetry is today, the current poets that we have writing, we have also certain expectations around that. Could you say something about this essay? I think it's so well put.
Well, thank you. The essay is, I think, well, first of all, I think you're right that we live in a poetry era, an era in poetry that's very politically driven and outward oriented toward the various wars that we're fighting. That has led to some really diverse, vibrant writing, and also some problems, I think. This essay is about veterans writing about war in particular, but I think the idea, and it can apply to all kinds of political writing, and it's arguing essentially for a understanding of war as, I guess, a rhetorical phenomenon, something that's talked about and sold and rationalized and argued over. as opposed to something that's simply witnessed or that's simply kind of seen in clean ethical binaries. A lot of veterans writing tends to be heavily descriptive, veterans poetry, descriptive, witnessing, imagistic. And that's, again, that's not a value judgment, that's just a description, but I want to argue more for situating the war as an object that is, I guess, rhetorically triangulated from many opposing sides. And I want to push poetry towards, I guess, a more kind of discourse-based or discursive understanding of war rather than simply kind of images, mm-hmm. I guess less as an event than as a object of discourse, war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, because you also talk about the aesthetics of it and mm-hmm. yeah, and also the point of view mm-hmm. that I think you're both probably really keenly aware of what that means, the point of view that you bring to your writing.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons veterans writing is so imagistic is because, you know, they've seen it in a way no one else has, and I think mm-hmm. that's one of the important functions of veterans writing is simply to document that.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned in the essay, Hugh Martin is a veteran poet who I think is doing it better than anybody today.
Mm-hmm. It's just this is an argument that goes back so long as well, and that you can track through the Civil War itself. And Edmund Wilson, one of his main problems with Melville was that he wasn't a veteran. He said mm-hmm. something about, like, how can one be writing this poetry when they haven't mm-hmm. gone through it, even though Melville did come and steep himself in the Civil War and mm-hmm. observed. But I think Battle Pieces is the best piece of literature, of poetry, to come out of the Civil War. But it was Thomas Buchanan Reed, who was celebrated at that time and kind of thought of the Civil War poet laureate, someone we don't even hear of really today, because it's all just, I mean, he wrote one poem about Sheridan's ride in, I think, 4 hours before an event. He was kind of commissioned. So he was like the engraving or newspaper type poet, and it's all bombastic and politically mm-hmm. rousing and quite memorable, but it's not aesthetically complex. It doesn't have that distance. And Melville was doing that really wonderful rhetorical thinking of it as an aesthetic event of the mm-hmm. war, which makes those poems, I think, quite more nuanced and complex and lasting.
Well, and one of the other points that I think of is in any war, there's only so much time spent on battle, and even though, so what the soldiers see and experience in battle is, you know, it's extremely important and must be witnessed to and documented, but more soldiers, not just in the Civil War, but in all kinds of wars, die from disease and or dehydration or diarrhea or just the boring stuff, right? And also people who are not fighting are experiencing war in so many different ways too, and so it can be trickier because it's not quite as overt, but it's not necessarily less. It's just different, you know, when it comes to the point of view.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up because when we were on our battlefield tour the other day, mm-hmm. it was our third one, and they're all remarkable, and we learn something new every time. By this time, we have a pretty good understanding of some of the main kind of logistics of the war. So mm-hmm. we were looking and wanted some different details, and Chris said something like, I want to know like where the soldiers went to the bathroom. And the guide said, well, they all had diarrhea. And we were both uh-huh. like, scribbling this down, because those mm-hmm. are the kind of details that really give a sense of like what life was like then. And there's the tedium, of course, the waiting, even the camaraderie in the waiting and mm-hmm. things like that, that is just sometimes as powerful as the great battles that we read about, and is the stuff of poetry.
Yeah, who was it that said war is boring? Anybody? Maybe I just made that up.
No. Is it Jarrell?
I don't know, maybe. I'm fascinated by like the downtime, and that's mm-hmm. what I think veteran writers do very well is they rarely write about battle. They're writing about, you know, Friday night at the base. What do? You play ping pong. Mm-hmm. I in the Civil War, all morning they sat around and drank coffee, you know, and had diarrhea everywhere. Yeah, I just that to me is important because it kind of counteracts or reduces the kind of, like you said, bombastic rhetoric of war, and it shows it as a, just kind of another material practice, you know?
Yeah. Would you be able to read a sample of your work? I would just love that.
Yeah, of course. Corey, do you want to go first here?
Oh, sure. So I said that I'm mostly working on essays and surrounding the cyclorama, but I also was working on a crown of sonnets. And I say sonnets, I should have a quotation mark around them. They're prose sonnets, and so you'll hear that they really don't sound that much like a sonnet at all. but I was trying to think about how to translate the sweeping panorama of the cyclorama into form. And so they're playing with just 14 lines, some span an entire page, and this one isn't quite as long, but this is dealing again with the cyclorama. And there's one line in here that I steal from Homer, I should say. So this is from Cyclorama. You see the horses first, one just fallen on the dirt path toward Vicksburg, dappled gray, his soldier crushed. A rebel cuts another from the carriage's ropes. Foreground, blood along a tawny neck. One, white, majestic, bucks his rider, is always bucking his rider, forever from history. Might it be easy to look away from the surgeon's bone saw? From the man slung between two others like a sack of flour. The barn wall left gaping, red brick exposed around the edges, like flesh. The stone wall singed black. Mead holds and holds, but barely. Cannons bruise the air, the open field, Lieutenant Colonel Franklin Sawyer, 8th Ohio, moans. The gray wave crying, unearthly lamentation over the water of the wheat, the rippling smoke. Never can the low stone become crossable. Never can the blonde youth slump back atop his steed, the saber unstick itself from the rib gap, nor the flesh above the knee. It's hard not to admire the trees, dwarfing our toy drama. They rise in plumes toward something, 377 feet of canvas tacked around the room.
Oh, thank you.
Of course.
The cannons bruising the air, that's just hanging with me right now.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I guess I'll read my cyclorama poem, too. For me, one of the appealing things about the cyclorama is that it's made from, like, I think 17 panels stitched together. And to me, that's such a profound metaphor for what a country is. States stitched together at a battle where so many bodies were stitched together. So I'm thinking of bodies and body politic. And I think for me, the cyclorama is a good instantiation of that. Let's see, what else does one have to know about this? Nothing, I don't think. And this is another poem just about the spectacle of this town. Cyclorama. Only with such care could history take form. For years, workers scraped rotted acrylic from the canvas, accretions of bug frass. For years, they inpainted the fields and generals, then, with surgical instruments, sewed in a fiberglass corset, hung the thing like a gown, so we could admire from a platform the order in Pickett's death parade. Neat lines marching in echelon, perspective like a minor god's. We have come like tourists to believe this, that we, from a certain angle, made clean in the workers' emulsions, are one in our manicured history. We could be at the beach. We could be at the blue and gray, getting drunk on $3 margaritas, tequila sunrise playing on the touch tunes, the usual locals beginning to sway. So we are obedient citizens today. We lean out above the guns and wagons the workers have added around the platform, fake horse paths winding off toward the hem of the painting. Impossible, a Boston newspaper reported at the unveiling, to say where the illusion begins. A veteran, I will show you where I stood. You see, this was before the internet. No satellite or drone lowered its camera yet to the field's frenzy. When men marched back to their campsites, they could know of battle barely more than the curtain of musket smoke they had moved inside, the smell of the man beside them. There, though, around the bonfire of their grief, they pieced their stories into narrative. This one, he swears, saw a pair of Union lieutenants torn clean from their horses by grape shot. Someone watched the ghost of Stonewall Jackson weeping near the peach orchard. Just so, the docent tells us, the workers stitched the painting's 18 panels together to a landscape, size of a football field, a flag they named like a tilt-a-whirl. What more could we honor ourselves so rightly with? We exit through the entrance. To mend it completely, they sewed back the sky.
Hmm, they sewed back the sky. And also, to remind us that it's the length of a football field, I mean, that's quite incredible. I mean, that's
yeah. It's, I can't imagine it unfurled like horizontal across a football field. Yeah. That's massive.
Wow. Yeah.
And so intricate throughout it. Like, just, I can't imagine painting a football field with that level of detail.
Well, I wish both of you all the best with your current projects that you have, that the rest of your residency is really just rich and fascinating. And
thank you.
There's one more question that I had about if you could each just say, so you're only about a third of the way into your residency right now, but is there one impression, is there something that you've heard or seen this time that has just been a little bit surprising or a little bit, I don't know, something that struck you? Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I think for me, the diarrhea comment was very impactful because he, our guide also said, our guide was John Knowles, I believe is his last, John Kroll, I think is his name. And he said, everybody had diarrhea, imagine the ground, he said. And that gives you some sense of just those kind of luminous details for me that like bring home this place in a way that, you know, I'm trying to think. Like even I don't know. And those are the most powerful details for me. Another thing he said was that he was talking about what he called acoustic shadows. And
ooh.
when the South was trying to attack on day two, to attack the Union lines on Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, what we know as the Fish Hook. They were trying to move in coordinated fashion from the south end of the Hook and the north end of the Fish Hook at the same time. They were trying to coordinate that attack. But Ewell at the north end could not hear when the attack started at the south end, even though they heard it as far away as Harrisburg.
Right.
And our guide was talking about the idea of like the hills kind of mask the sound here. And so something they heard 30 miles away that we could not hear 3 miles away. And that idea of like, again, coordinating a body is to me an interesting one thinking about the country as a body and individual bodies that lose coordination and the body of the army not being able to coordinate itself. That to me, I think, is a profound metaphor for a country falling apart.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's a combination of something that I read, or actually Chris read, and then kind of solidified that it was here. I think it was maybe about a year ago. I remember Chris saying something about a cow that during the battle had been, you know, somehow set free from the pasture, and this is... I think, how long was it later that it came back?
Like, I think 2 months or 2 weeks.
Yeah, a long time. It just wandered back and with its calf too, I believe. And I just kind of remember this going through one ear, coming out the other. And the other day I read that it was the Klingle farm where we're staying that lost the cow. And so I walked out the door the morning after reading this and just imagined seeing the cow coming up from the fields that was lost. And this was a farm that was devastated. And he lost almost all of his, I believe he was a shoemaker, and almost all of his equipment was ruined. His animals were killed. And his daughter died shortly after. And so I can only imagine like this one tiny bit of triumph to be felt from a personal, vision coming through that field. And so that was something that I really had to be here to feel the gravity of in living in that house. And I could be wrong, but I'm almost positive it said that it was the Klingle house.
So. Wow.
They were eating dinner and they looked up and the cow was outside.
Wow. That's great. It's a little resurrection.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, exactly. Absolutely.
Well, you have been listening to The Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain. My guests have been Corey Van Lanningham and Chris Kempf, poets serving as artists in residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Visit their websites at coreyvanlanningham.com and christopherkempf.com. And visit our friends at the National Park Arts Foundation.org. Chris and Corey, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having us.
How fun.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.